I will call this hearing of Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee to order. Today is January 31st, 2023. All hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. A quorum is present, so we will get started. The first item on the agenda is the minutes. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 26, 2023? That's fine. We'll move that to the end. We'll get the minutes. Thank you. Our first bill up on the agenda is House File 2 by Representative Richardson, which is paid family and medical leave provided. I will move that House File 2 be referred to the Children and Families Finance and Policy Committee. Representative Richardson, proceed with your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2 would create a statewide family and medical leave benefit program and would provide a much-needed safety net for families who need to take time away from work to care for a new child, care for a sick family member with a serious health condition, or to recover themselves. As this committee discussion will be limited to the provisions within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee, before we do a brief walkthrough of the relevant provisions, I wanted to share some background on the fact that the paid family and medical leave program we have proposed is modeled after our longstanding unemployment insurance program. So several of the terms and procedures in the relevant sections reflect current approaches used within our UI program, as well as the data sharing necessary to administer the program. Today I have with me Ms. Deb Fitzpatrick, who will do a brief walkthrough of the relevant provisions under the committee's jurisdiction.
Thank you, Representative. Ms. Fitzpatrick.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Frazier, members of the committee. And my name is Deborah Fitzpatrick. I'm the Director of Policy and Research at Children's Defense Fund, Minnesota. In my prior role at the University of Minnesota, I led the research team that conducted Minnesota's legislatively mandated design and implementation study under contract with DEED. Representative Richardson mentioned, I'm just going to run through the sections of the bill that relate to this committee's jurisdiction at a high level, and we'll have folks from DEED to here to answer questions. Article 1, Section 1, 4, and 5 relate to data sharing relevant for administration of the chapter. DEED and DLI share enforcement activities under the bill that may be facilitated by data sharing. Data is also generally private, again, unless that is the need for DEED and DLI to share that data. That's Section 1. Section 4 allows the paid family and medical leave program to access UI data where helpful for program administration. And then in Section 5, there are some definitions that relate to data collection. I think most notably the wage detail report definition. I think I just wanted to, as Representative Richardson mentioned, that wage detail report that's required under this program is designed to be exactly the same as the wage detail that's currently required under the UI program. So employers would not have to create a separate report. They might have to submit the same report to two places, but it wouldn't be a different kind of report. So as Representative Richardson mentioned, there are several sections in the bill that are designed to, that literally are lifted from UI statute to, again, sort of build on that expertise. Those sections include Section 12, which allows an appeal to the Court of Appeals once an applicant or employer has been through the entire appeal process, administrative appeal process. Section 17 of the late fees that are included, Section 21, Section 22, 26, 29, 30, and 31. These sections, again, are all modeled on UI statute, providing similar processes for a collection of funds due to the department from employers or workers, processes for obtaining information necessary to administer these processes, penalties, dealing with child support, etc. And as I mentioned, DEED is on hand if there are questions about these particular sections. I would just like to lift up Section 15. This is new because this program does allow employers to offer a private plan in place of the public program, and the employer penalties in this section are permissive. I just wanted to underline that. Right now, the language is that the commissioner may apply these penalties as seems appropriate to the commissioner. And then finally, Section 14 relates to employment protections. The bill provides employment protected leave entitlements and allows employees to take concerns to the courts if necessary. So the remedy section of this bill is designed to mirror remedies already available through the federal FMLA for the same types of protections under that law. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Ms. Fitzpatrick. And Representative Richmond, I see we do have one testifier. Would Ms. Angela Schwayz-Nettle please come to testify? Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Hi, my name is Angela Schwayz-Nettle, and I own Moon Palace Books, where I live in Minneapolis, and I'm part of the Main Street Alliance. I know this committee is focusing on some of the technical aspects of the bill, but I want you to be grounded in why we need this program. Last year, my store manager, Heidi's father, died. He had Parkinson's, and we knew that he wasn't going to live much longer, and talked about how to plan for Heidi to take time off so that she could be there for him and her family. I didn't want her to worry about money, and I didn't want her to feel like she had to quit or that there was a limit to how much time she could spend with him before he died. And I had enough money set aside to pay her while she took time off. Even with all of our planning, it ended up being much more than we expected. Most people live 5 to 7 days without food and water, but her dad lived for another 21 days, and Heidi ended up needing to take off about 6 weeks total. I would have loved to have had paid family and medical leave that wasn't dependent on me having a good year or planning ahead or only having one employee that needed paid time off. This is a disadvantage for small businesses who can't compete with corporations that have the means and resources to offer this benefit. I can't imagine how it would have felt to say that I couldn't do it because I didn't have enough money or to ask her to come back to work before she was ready. I would want to be able to take time off if someone in my family got sick, and it shouldn't depend on me having enough money or wanting to do the right thing. That's why I want a policy passed that offers 12 paid weeks of both family and medical leave and is state-administered like our unemployment insurance program. I'm excited that this will be prioritized this session and look forward to a more equitable Minnesota with this policy passed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schwayz-Nettle, and thank you for doing what you can to accommodate that worker. Thank you. Before we move on to amendments, I'd like to ask, are there any public members that would like to testify on behalf of House File 2? Seeing none, we have two amendments that have been pre-filed for House File 2. Representative Niska, would you like to start by moving the A9 amendment and explaining your amendment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would like to move the A9 amendment. And the A9 amendment is aimed at tightening up the definition of the leave that's set forth in Section 13, which would create a new 286B.085. The way that this, the concern that gives rise to this amendment is the way that this provision interacts with the employment protections and potential liability for employers in the next section. And in particular, the concern that motivated us to introduce this amendment is that by placing on employers sort of an undefined obligation to calculate eligibility for leave, that with a corresponding requirements to offer the reinstatement in the position or things like that, with potentially pretty onerous liability and penalties if they miscalculate that eligibility. We wanted to try to tighten up that definition so that the employers would have the ability to rely on whether the state is determining they're eligible for leave benefits. And so the purpose of this is to bring the leave right in line with the benefits that the state is calculating, rather than leaving it on an employer to just guess as to whether or not an employee is eligible for the leave provided by the bill. So that's the purpose of it. It's really aimed at trying to prevent a situation in which an employer has sort of an indeterminate potential huge liability trap that they're falling into, and to try to make it more predictable for employers and employees to know when they have these leave benefits and what the potential liabilities are for it, Mr. Chair. So that's the purpose of the A9 amendment, and I would move its adoption.
Thank you, Representative Niskey. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Niska, for bringing forth the amendment. As you stated, this amendment would change eligibility for the employment protected leave, and it would apply only to those employees that have been awarded benefits under the state program or a private plan. Under the way that the bill is currently constructed, it gives the power to make decisions about whether to combine like paid time off with the state program when an individual takes leave. So with this amendment, if an employee would use PTO to cover a portion of that leave, it could result in them not having employee protections. I am definitely open to working with you on this language. The current bill, you know, protects the employee's privacy by only including deed in the medical certification process. But I think that you raised some good things for discussion, and happy to work with you on that. But in the current form, I would recommend a no vote.
Thank you, Representative Richardson. Any discussion to the A9 amendment? Seeing none. All those in favor of adopting the A9 amendment?
Aye.
All those opposed to adopting the A9 amendment?
No.
The amendment does not pass. Up next, we have the A10. Representative Scott, would you like to move the A10 and explain it?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. I would move the A10, and I'll explain it a little bit. It just puts a good faith piece into this reporting mechanism. The employers are required to do these quarterly filings, and of course this is a brand new program. The learning curve is going to be pretty great, and so this just says, you know, if the employer is acting in good faith, they didn't omit an employee, or they didn't or if they failed to report something precisely as required, that if it was found that it was in good faith, that the penalties wouldn't start accruing, they would allow a little bit of grace there. And thank you for the conversation briefly on the House floor last night, and I hope members will support the bill.
Thank you, Lee Scott. Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for talking to me last night to give me a heads up on this. As we discussed yesterday, I think you make a very good point. And when we talked yesterday, I got clarification from you that your intent was to have this amendment applied to the section, not to the entire chapter. So happy to work with you on the amendment. And in the current form, it references both the section and the chapter. And so if you're willing to work to get that related to the specific section, happy to get that on at a later committee stop.
Thank you, Chair. And I'm just wondering if we could call on House Research to clarify what change would need to be made on this amendment to do what the author is asking.
House Research.
Chair and members, Mary Davis from House Research Department. I believe the change would be at 1.4, chapter would become section, and at 1.5, chapter would become section.
Thank you, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that anything that we could, does anybody not understand what this is doing? Is that something we could do in committee today? I don't know if the bill's author is amenable to that, but.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, Representative Scott, I would be amenable to that.
Okay, perfect. So, Mr. Chair, I would move an amendment to the amendment, an oral amendment then, and change on lines 1.4 where it says chapter to section, and on 1.5 where it says chapter to section. And ask for member support.
Thank you. Ms. Davis, could you please repeat that?
Chair and members, Mary Davis from House Research. The amendment would to the A10 would be line 1, page 1, line 4, delete chapter and insert section. And on page 1, line 5, delete chapter and insert section.
Thank you. So with an oral amendment to the amendment, any discussion to that, members? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor to the oral amendment to the amendment, please vote. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? The amendment is accepted. Now on to discussion of the bill. Any discussion of the Sorry. A10 amendment as amendment has been accepted.
No, we need to vote on the
A10. Oh, okay. Catching up.
It's okay. You're new to this.
Catching up. A10 amendment as amendment. Now we will vote on the A10 amendment as amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the A10 amendment as amendment has been adopted.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bearing with me. Now we move on to discussion of the bill. Members, any discussion of the bill as amended? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have several questions of the bill's author. I'm curious on 29, page 29.5. It's talking about the applicant obtaining benefits through misrepresentation, and I'm wondering what are the consequences in this bill of an applicant misrepresenting their qualifications for the benefits, if the bill author could.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. And Representative Scott, you said 29. What line are you on?
29 point lines 5 through 7. It's a letter B there.
Thank you. So the you know, in terms of thinking about what the remedies would be, it would reflect what is currently done within the UI program as well. And so as we look at the program, it would be a reflection of how it is currently handled under UI.
Representative Scott.
Mr. Chair, thank you. To the bill's author, Representative Richards, I don't know what that statute says. That's not something that we deal with a lot here. I don't know if somebody from D could give us an idea of what that looks like.
Is there anyone from DEED? Come down, please. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Evan Rowe. I'm Deputy Commissioner for Workforce Services and Operations here at DEED.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so my understanding is that this language is substantially related to the unemployment insurance legislation. That's Chapter 268 of Minnesota statutes. If you give me a second, I can take a look to track down the exact section of the statute. Two 268.18 is the section it's largely based on. Subdivision 2, to be specific, overpayment based on misrepresentation.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so to the testifier, so what are the consequences for an employee of misrepresentation, whether it's the UI or this? I'm not sure what those consequences are, if you could tell us.
Mr. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, so for House 2, there's specific reference to making a person ineligible as a result of misrepresentation. I think that's at Section B. Farther down in the draft legislation at Subdivision 5, there's elements around overpayment of benefits as well.
Representative Scott.
Thank you. And to the testifier, if the bill's author or you could walk us through the overpayment piece, is there a clawback if an employee has misrepresented, been overpaid? What does that then look like?
Representative Richardson or Mr. Rowe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Scott, for the question. Under Subdivision 5 overpayment, it relates back to the UI statute in 268B, 185, and return to repayment obligations.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the testifier was getting ready to maybe add to that. No?
Mr. Rowe?
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I think at Subdivision 5, I think there's specific language that says there's a requirement that the overpaid benefits must be repaid according to 268B.185.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so, and I don't know how this works in UI. I know that there's been a study that came out nationally, especially during COVID, that there was, I think, somewhere around $800 million that were fraudulently gained. And I haven't seen any determination here on the, Minnesota specific, but I'm wondering, so can the state or the department in this case, can they turn this over to a collection agency, for instance, if they're not getting anywhere? What does that look like?
Mr. Rowe or Representative Richardson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Within the bill, there are opportunities to turn things over to collection agencies, and there's also opportunities to work with the Office of Inspector General if there would be any concerns about fraud or misrepresentation as well.
Mr. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I think there, in a very similar manner to the unemployment insurance program, there is the ability to collect and levy and do garnishments as appropriate to ensure that any benefits obtained through misrepresentation can be returned to the Paid Family Medical Leave Fund contemplated under the legislation. I think it's at 55.7.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to go to the records and audit piece next on page 54. Are there current parameters with the unemployment, and are there any differences between what happens with unemployment and what would happen with, I'm assuming there would be on this bill as far as the data that is needed to enforce this new law. Are there any parameters on what data would actually be needed to enforce the law, and is there a retention period for keeping the data? This is, can be pretty sensitive data. It's health information in a lot of cases. So I'm just concerned about that.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott, for the question. There are data retention requirements of a period of at least 4 years, which again is a clone of the current UI information. There's also authority to the commissioner to conduct audits and investigations of, when necessary to administer the program, and to set penalties for failure to comply. And I don't know if there's additional information from the department.
Mr. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I think the language is substantively similar to the UI language in that regard. I think the idea is that, you know, it's important that accurate records are kept, and certainly the point around medical data, you know, I think that would be a question of making sure that sensitivity and care is taken in the design of any such system.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. And my concern is there's going to be a lot of information flowing back and forth between two departments and even health providers, and you're adding that piece to it that's not currently in unemployment. And so I just want to make sure that, and I know in the UI statute, I don't think there's any requirement for audit trails to make sure that only what's necessarily being sent back and forth is audited to make sure that it's role-based access, those sorts of things. I would really like, and I know we're not on UI right now, but I just feel like there needs to be some tightening up there to make sure that people's very personal information is protected, and that there's maybe an outline of the specific data sets that you're going to need to collect, and make sure that obviously that again there's only role-based access to that information, and that it's protected going back and forth, because I'm not an IT expert, but what I understand is anytime data is being transferred, that's when it's the most vulnerable to hacking and those sorts of things. And I just want to make sure that might be tightened up, and I'm willing to work with the author on that, but I don't know if the author or our testifier has any comment to that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Richardson or Mr. Rowe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Scott. You know, the intent of this is to ensure that it's the minimum information that's necessary in order to administer the program. You know, state employees do abide by an ethical code of conduct as it relates to, like, data privacy, but happy to continue conversations in terms of ways to ensure that the data that would be used would be limited to what's actually necessary to administer the program, and to ensure that enforcement could occur as well. So appreciate your offer on that.
Mr. Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I'll just say, you know, on a high level, both the unemployment insurance system and the administration take that extraordinarily seriously. Data security is absolutely essential in everything that we do. I think the legislation contemplates classifying this data as private data, right, under the MGDPA. So there's that security and safeguard. But what I would just say is, you know, within the current UI system and any system that would be built as a result of the Paid Family Medical Leave Program, great care and caution would be taken in designing both business process and any IT infrastructure to ensure that there is role-based access, internal audit trails to ensure that sensitive data is being handled appropriately in line with best practices and all modern cybersecurity approaches. That's something we take incredibly seriously.
Thank you, Mr. Rowe. Representative Scott, any follow-up?
I'll let some of our other members ask questions.
All right. Representative Waynes.
Chair Fraser and Representative Richardson. In this day where more and more people are hired that work remotely, a business that is located outside of Minnesota hires someone who chooses to work remotely from Minnesota, will they be held to the bill's requirements?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Weens, for the question. You know, as we've seen a rise in remote work, that does require that employers are following the laws of the states wherever their employees are located. And so that includes not only for paid family medical leave programs, but also for unemployment insurance as well. So that, I mean, that's a current requirement right now in terms of employers being able to follow the laws of the state that their employees are located in.
Any follow-up, Representative Weens?
Oh, thank you, Representative Richardson. I'm concerned about our competitiveness and understanding that. Thank you very much, Chair.
Representative Niska.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I do have some follow-up questions on the line of questioning Representative Scott had about the benefit overpayments provision. But first, I wanted to ask if the bill author or anyone knows when we're going to see a fiscal note on this bill.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are still currently waiting for a fiscal note.
Representative Niska.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Rowe, I appreciate you pointing out the parallels between what would be Section 268B.185 and 268.15 or 0.18. I did notice a few differences that seem substantively significant, and I wanted to ask about if I'm missing that, you know, the language has been moved somewhere else or is in a different places, and maybe the reasons for if there is a substantive difference, maybe the reasons for the policy choices that were made there. So in this bill on 51.24, after that, after what would be subdivision 2A, I noticed comparing that to 268.18 subdivision 2A, in the unemployment insurance provision, it says it adds language, after the discovery of facts indicating misrepresentation, the commissioner must issue a determination of overpayment penalty, assessing a penalty equal to 40% of the amount overpaid. This penalty is in addition to penalties under Section 268.183. That language does not appear to have carried over into this provision, and I was curious as to the reason for that, or if it's somewhere else. Why are we not imposing the same type of penalty to benefit overpayments in this context as we are in the unemployment insurance context?
I see other folks joining. Representative Richardson, or please introduce yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jessica Webster. I'm a staff attorney with Legal Aid. I have worked in the unemployment insurance system for about 16 years, and I serve on DEED's Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council, which is a stakeholder group of sorts which works in the weeds on these issues. So there are a couple of modifications between unemployment insurance and paid family leave in the overpayment context. But I think it's also important to note that some of those modifications are also moving for unemployment insurance through the legislature this year. So, excuse me, some of the modifications you see are because in the unemployment insurance system, the fees and fines that we have set for folks who sometimes make mistakes can spiral from $500 or $1,000 to $11,000, $15,000, which are folks, some of the folks that we saw during COVID that were eligible for unemployment insurance but couldn't access because of a back overpayment and because of how the system works. So this bill and the unemployment insurance statutes are looking to modify some of those fines and fees so that we don't have a debtor's prison of sorts and have the state setting these predatory levels of collection.
Thank you. Representative Niski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the explanation. I will just flag for the members as well a number of other places in which this provision is not modeled after the existing unemployment provision. So subdivision, there's an entire subdivision or section B in subdivision 2, again in 268.18, that creates a finality of determination for the determination of overpayment penalty. Again, perhaps the legislature is also going to consider deleting that language from the unemployment insurance provision, but that is not present here. The subdivision 6 starting on line page 52, line 15 of this bill, the cancellation of overpayments is new language that's not in the current unemployment insurance statute. And then subdivision 7 below that is also missing a paragraph A that is in the unemployment insurance in that provision, it's subdivision six, that the commissioner may not compromise the amount of any overpaid unemployment benefits, including penalty and interest. So, you know, I guess to the whenever we do as a legislature consider these provisions in the unemployment insurance context, I would again echo Representative Scott's concern that that there is a pretty significant risk of fraud and overpayment and loss of benefits to or overpayment of benefits to individuals who aren't entitled to it lawfully, and that this is watering down the ability to for the commissioner of deed and for the state in general to safeguard the state's treasury in that circumstance. So
I'm sorry, I didn't catch your name.
Madam Chair, my name is Jessica Webster.
Webster, all right, Ms. Webster, go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative, it in no way waters down the overpayment collection. So every overpayment has to be repaid. You heard that Deed has tools to collect those overpayments. For a misrepresentation penalty or misrepresentation overpayment, there is a penalty, that there's interest that runs on that. We do have, they stay on the books for a while, so Deed can look back, find those overpayments, still chase them, use the tools at their disposal. So it's not watered down in any way in terms of how we go about collecting those overpayments, making sure there's integrity in the system. It's just that the way that the unemployment insurance works right now, we're snagging people, we're catching people in sometimes mistakes. And as Representative Scott said, this is a new system that's going to be up and running. It's going to be new for employers. It's going to be new for workers. And we don't want to have mistakes lead to multiple $1,000 overpayments that people are paying 8 years later after it happens. So that's what this system is trying to do. And that's what the unemployment insurance system, frankly, is hoping to do this year, too, with looking at some modifications in their system as well. Thank you.
All very interesting. However, paid family medical leave is the bill before us, and we do have another bill on the calendar today. Further follow-up, Representative Niska.
Just one comment. The witness, and I'm sorry, I didn't completely catch your name.
Webster.
Ms. Webster did make a statement that overpayments must be repaid, and there certainly are some provisions here which allow for either cancellation or discretion about recovery of overpayments. I just wanted to make sure that that's clarify that the bill clearly does allow for some circumstances in which overpayments would not be repaid. Thank you.
All right. Representative Scott, and then we'll move on to the vote.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to ask a question regarding self-employed people. So I'm looking for confirmation on how this bill would impact independent contractors and self-employed individuals. My reading of various definitions and provisions in the bill is that an independent contractor whose occupation status as an independent contractor is referenced in Minnesota statute and rule is not considered an employee under this bill and subject to mandatory participation in the program. However, independent contractors and self-employed individuals may instead choose to voluntarily participate in the program. Is that a correct understanding of what the bill does?
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And yes, that is correct. So for folks who are self-employed, they could opt in to the program if they met the eligibility requirements.
Thank you, Madam.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn. And members of this, if we're going to take the vote, I'll just kind of wrap up here. But we heard today a lot about we talked a little bit about the overpayment issue and how much grace is being extended to the employee who misrepresents or gets benefits that they're really not entitled to. We stated before, and thank you for taking the amendment, Madam Chair, to the author of the bill, Representative Richardson. Again, it's similar to the paid sick and safe time that we passed earlier this week. My concern is that the same grace isn't always extended to the employer. We've got a tenfold increase in the penalties to the employers, but it just doesn't seem that's on balance with the grace that's extended to someone that receives overpayment. And members, I think there's a lot of work left to be done in this bill, and I'm happy to work with the bill's author, and I hope she's amenable to also working with some of our job providers who are reeling over, you know, this brand new, I don't know how many total pages this bill is, but 60 pages or so maybe, this new government program that they're going to have to adjust to in a short amount of time. And so I will be voting no today. I believe that employers right now that can offer this benefit are doing so because they can afford to do so. It's particularly hard on small businesses with just a handful of employees. And so, members, I would encourage a no vote. And I'll wrap up my comments. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Moving on to the vote, I will renew it was Representative Frazier's motion to re-refer House File 2 as amended to the Children and Families Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails, and House File 2 is on to another committee. Thank you, Representative Richardson. We have another bill on the agenda today. While we're getting people moving around, let's move the minutes. I understand that we didn't have a paper copy in members' packets, so we will move on to the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes of January 26th?
Rebecca Finn, I'll move over.
Representative Johnson moves the minutes. Any discussion to the minutes? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? All right. The minutes are approved. Thank you, Anna. And folks, if we can try to get out of the room quietly out of respect to the other bill we have up today. Thank you. Gossip. Got it. All right. Representative Finke, would you like to move your bill before the committee?
I would.
All right. Representative Finke moves House File 146 before the committee. I understand that you do have an author's amendment that's purely technical in nature, the A1 amendment. Would you like to move that amendment as well?
Yes, I would. Yes, this is just a technical amendment to correct drafting errors.
Yeah, it looks like it's just changing a number, a word.
It's changing the code that is being referenced. There were some mistakes in the code.
Yep, pretty straightforward. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? All right, the motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Finke, please tell us.
What is the motion on the bill? Where is the motion?
The bill is before us.
Correct, but is the motion to send the bill to the General Register?
So your question, Representative Niska, is... There is a motion before us. The bill is before us. My intention is that we would lay over this bill at this point. Very, yep. All right. Representative Finke, please tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and members. My name is Representative Lee Finke. My pronouns are she, her. This is the first committee hearing in the history of our state legislature that will hear a bill designed to protect trans and gender expansive people in Minnesota. This is literally the first convening of our community for a bill that will help us live. Even if trans issues are new to the legislature, please know that the trans community has always existed. We have long been organized. In the 1990s, the transsexual menace organized around trans media representation. In the 1980s, the International Foundation for Gender Education organized to educate the world about our existence. In the 1970s, the Street Transvestite Action Revolutionaries organized to keep us alive. Gender expansive folks were at Stonewall, we were at Dewey's Restaurant before that, and at Cooper Donuts before that. You can Google those references. Our community is as historic and varied and beautiful as any other in the human experience. And yet, this is our first time at the microphone because we finally have political representation. For the first time, we have not one but two gender-expansive lawmakers in the Minnesota state government. Shout out to Representative Kozlowski. Representation matters. So I'm grateful to Chair Beckerfin for the opportunity to hear this bill and for giving me a moment to recognize the history that our community is making today. To the bill, HF 146 would make Minnesota into a trans refuge state by protecting trans people, their families, and medical practitioners from the legal repercussions of traveling to Minnesota to receive gender-affirming care. We are a state that prides ourselves on providing world-class health care and making that health care accessible to everyone who needs it. This need is desperate in my community. This is not a hypothetical scenario. There are gender-diverse people in Minnesota right now receiving gender-affirming care. More are fleeing their home states, asking where they should turn. There are people in the audience today who have come here for this very reason. There are doctors in Minnesota right now providing this world-class gender-affirming care. And there are parents who are terrified about what unknown consequences may come from simply affirming their child's authentic self. This is new law. It's complex, and there are questions that still need to be answered. But we can answer those questions, and we need to do so right now. Utah banned gender-affirming care last Saturday. They were not the first state to do so, and they will not be the last. Tennessee is close behind them. South Dakota is moving. The organized political movement that has targeted my community is at work in every state that touches ours. It has been said that Minnesota is an abortion island and that we must protect our right to reproductive freedom on behalf of our neighbors. And we must. But likewise, we must recognize that Minnesota is an island of gender-affirming care as well. And we must protect this right too for everyone. I'll now turn it over to Dr. Gepford. They will add their testimony.
Right. Dr. Gepford, please introduce yourself and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Dr. Angela K. Gepford. I use they and she pronouns. Chair Beckerfin and committee members, thank you for having me today. I am the Chief Education Officer and the Medical Director for the Gender Health Program at Children's Minnesota. I've been a pediatrician caring for the kids of this state for the last 17 years, and I'm here today to express Children's Minnesota's support for House File 146. I'm also here with Representative Finke today to dispel myths that have been spread, intentionally or unintentionally, that harm transgender young people and place them at the center of a political battle that does not belong to them. I'm here to let you know that gender-affirming care is health care. It is specialized health care provided by teams with training and expertise and evidence-based care, just like any other pediatric specialty that we provide for kids at Children's Minnesota. But first, I'd like to tell you about Jessica, whose name has been changed for my testimony. Jessica is a 6-year-old transgender girl who I met shortly after our program opened 3 years ago. Jessica and her family drove to Minneapolis from South Dakota to seek care at our program because Jessica so desperately wanted to play soccer. Her parents drove her to Minnesota from South Dakota because in order for Jessica to play soccer, her parents were required to submit her birth certificate, which would reveal that she was transgender. Her parents were so terrified of what that could mean for her and their family in the small rural town in which they lived, and their local pediatrician refused to help their family with a letter of support to amend her birth certificate. Helping 6-year-old Jessica play soccer is gender-affirming care. At its root, gender-affirming care is listening to, understanding, and supporting transgender young people and their families, and it includes both mental health and medical care. At Children's Minnesota, we follow guidelines outlined by the World Professional Association for Transgender Health and the Pediatric Endocrine Society that are supported by every major medical organization in this country and across the world. The majority of care that we provide in our clinic involves no medications. It is about helping families answer questions about their developing child. We share information about non-medical interventions such as shapewear and voice therapy. For adolescents who are in their second stage of puberty, some may access reversible medications to suppress their puberty. Older young adults who are ready from a medical and mental health standpoint may access partially reversible gender-affirming hormones. All of our care is age-appropriate. All of our care is provided with parental consent. We do not perform gender-affirming surgeries at Children's. Every day that I am in clinic, I hear from patients and families in this state who wonder if they will have to flee our state in order to continue to love and support their transgender child. There are thousands of Minnesota families listening to every single word spoken here today, knowing that their child's life and their family's future depends on the outcome of this bill. Across the country are domestic refugees, parents and children who are forced to leave the state that they currently call home to find a place where their children and families belong and will not be persecuted for their identities. So thank you, Representative Finke, for your incredible leadership on this historic and life-saving bill. This bill sends a message that we love and value and support all kids here in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. I do have quite a few testifiers signed up. Next on the list, I have Dr. Mark Lynn. Please introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and committee members. My name is Dr. Mark Lynn. I use he, him pronouns. I'm a certified pediatric psychologist and a member of the Gender Health Program's Integrated Care team at Children's Minnesota. I am grateful to join you today to express my emphatic support for House File 146. Representative Finke, thank you for your incredible leadership on this bill. I've always been drawn to fight for the underdog, and my years of scientific training and clinical practice have prepared me to support and protect kids and their families, collaborating to create the conditions that empower them to live out their best, most authentic, and staggeringly brilliant selves. Our clinic's work with transgender and gender diverse youth across our state is evidence of the healthy, healing, and protective outcomes that are possible when following best practice standards in pediatric gender health. The floods of misinformation regarding gender care are well debunked by factual evidence, including studies of now middle-aged adults who have thrived since receiving gender-affirming care as youth in the mid-1990s. Research shows kids and teens who can access critical gender care services go on to experience reduced levels of depression, anxiety, and related markers of distress, often to similar levels as their cisgender peers. Every week I see these benefits in the lives of kids and their families who fiercely love and support them. We know gender care, but they know their children. And they ask us all of the crucial questions, including those that are being asked broadly in the media as part of the national conversation on gender care. Over the course of our work, parents who feared they were losing the child they once knew learned that their child was never lost, but simply is more of themselves than they ever were able to live out before receiving gender-affirming care. I regularly hear from families who have made contingency plans, some have even made go bags, in the event that our state follows others that have sided with fear over facts. Science doesn't look different in red states or blue states. The wide host of risk factors, including suicide, are real. I want to emphasize the fundamental rights that these kids and teens have, not just in our state, but across the nation. These include the right to simply be, the right to take for granted all of the things that cisgender kids can take for granted. This is gender-affirming care. Minnesota has the opportunity to send a clear message to kids and families throughout our nation. Here, you can't expect that our state will be for you, guided by science that is backed up by lived experience. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, I have Dr. Kelsey Leonard-Smith. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Chair Beckerfin and committee members, my name is Dr. Kelsey Leonard-Smith. I use she and they pronouns. I'm the interim medical director and director of the Child and Adolescent Transgender Care Program at Family Tree Clinic in Minneapolis, as well as a family physician who cares for children and their families across the lifespan. Today I'm here speaking in support of House File 146 on behalf of Family Tree Clinic. I would consider myself a very lucky doctor, blessed to spend my days with a beautiful diversity of patients and families, but caring for transgender children and young adults has been the most rewarding part of my career. They've taught me so much about what it means to be human. And supporting them through gender-affirming care, getting to watch them thrive, is an incredible gift. But their thriving and access to life-giving medical care should never be in question. It is the mere fact that our kids have to live in a world where their access to health care is being limited and debated that puts them at risk. When I say gender-affirming care, what does that mean? Well, at Family Tree Clinic, it means something different to each child and family. It means meeting them and their families wherever they are on their journey through life and working as a team to provide evidence-based care appropriate to their developmental stage. It might mean coaching one child's parents on how to help grandma get a new name right or how to safely find a chest binder and use it correctly. We know that something as simple as using a child's chosen name at school or at home can reduce things like suicidality by 56%. As Dr. Gepford mentioned, there are no medical interventions that we use in children before puberty. At Family Tree Clinic, we practice in line with the World Association of Transgender Health and the Endocrine Society. In adolescents who have already begun puberty, we do sometimes use medications to prevent that puberty process from causing permanent changes that could lead to lifelong distress. In older adolescents who have passed certain milestones of intellectual development and who can demonstrate their capacity to make medical decisions, along with the consent of their legal guardians, we may initiate semi-reversible hormonal medications. In young people, medication doses are low, changes are very slow to develop, often to their frustration. At each follow-up visit, we're really reassessing this person's needs. What does the person sitting in front of us need today, and what do we think you're going to need 10 or 20 years from now? We use these medications because they work, and I have a kind of job where patients and families routinely like cry from joy in my office and relief because they feel so much better. We use these medications because the studies that compare patients who were able to access them with those who wanted to access them but could not have found dramatic long-term improvements in quality of life and mental health. At Family Tree Clinic, we've long served patients from across the upper Midwest, but in the past 2 years especially, that reach has really expanded further as families travel and relocate to prevent disruptions in their child's care. Our staff have fielded just heartbreaking phone calls from parents in Texas, Arkansas, Florida, who are terrified for their child's well-being. As a parent of three young children, as such fears really resonate deeply with me. I know one family who actually chose to replace their car because they were afraid that legal changes would push them to flee the country and that their unreliable vehicle might not make it all the way to the border. In Minnesota, we have a long history of protecting the rights of LGBT people, something I'm very proud of, and I'm really grateful to Representative Finke for introducing House Bill 146. This bill protects vital life-saving health care in our state. It reminds us that for many, waiting for care and preventing access to expert medical teams is harmful. It reminds us that transgender kids belong everywhere and have the right to thrive everywhere. Thank you.
Thank you. Next on the list, I have Christy Hall and then Krista Mosing on deck. Right, not seeing Christy.
I haven't seen Christy.
Okay, Krista Mosing. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Beckerfin, members of the committee. My name is Krista Mosing, or she, her. I've been a licensed Minnesota attorney since 2008. I've served as a state executive branch attorney in various roles since 2011. And I'm the current chair of Inclusive, the LGBTQIA plus resource group for state employees. I'm testifying before you today in my personal capacity. I'll first briefly touch on the legal context of House File 146 and then discuss the effectiveness and enforceability of its provisions. Minnesota has a long history of leading the recognition and protection of the human rights of trans people. This year marks the 30th anniversary of Minnesota becoming the first state to enact a law protecting the human rights of trans people. Minnesota's human rights law borrows language from a 1975 Minneapolis ordinance protecting trans civil rights. Yet now anti-trans legislation is expanding. In 32 states, nearly 250 bills are currently under consideration that would single out trans people for discriminatory treatment of their privacy, their family relationships, and their rights to access public accommodations and health care. House File 146 would protect children, families, and caregivers in Minnesota from extraterritorial laws and orders that could interfere with the right to receive gender-affirming health care in Minnesota. The bill could offer some protection to children, families, and care providers when people travel to Minnesota for gender-affirming health care and then return to a state with such a law. Sections 2 through 4 of the bill amend the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act. These sections clarify how to implement the bill's policy favoring child health and welfare when performing a child custody jurisdictional analysis. These provisions are narrow in scope, focusing on jurisdictional analysis to ensure that the state's interest in the child's welfare is not unnecessarily relinquished. The approach taken in House File 146 appears to be consistent with federal law. Sections 6 through 10 amend the Uniform Criminal Extradition Act. The extradition-related provisions will protect individuals and families by preventing their removal for exercising their rights in Minnesota. These sections are narrowly tailored to circumstances where Minnesota's discretion is not constrained by federal law. Sections 6, 7, 9, and 10 concern only acts committed in or services received in Minnesota. Sections 7 and 8 amend provisions where extradition is discretionary and not mandatory. The careful tailoring of these provisions ensures that they are likely effective and enforceable. For these reasons, the bill does not appear to interfere with any obligation to accord full faith and credit to acts, records, and judicial proceedings of another state. Overall, House File 146 would protect healthcare recipients and providers who are subject to Minnesota's jurisdiction from undue interference and attempted punishment by or through the laws of another state. This bill is not merely a statement. It would substantively strengthen Minnesota's human rights advantage among the United States.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, I have Kat Roan, and then on deck, I have Rebecca Della Hunt. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Representative Finke, Chair Becker Finn, committee members. My name is Kat Roan, and I am the executive director for Outfront Minnesota, our state's largest LGBTQ advocacy organization, and I am a proud member of our state's trans community. Today, I come to offer my support for HF 146 to help ensure Minnesota is a place of refuge for transgender and gender expansive individuals, supportive families, and care providers. Trans and gender expansive individuals know who we are, and we thrive when we are given the support and care we need. This bill is unfortunately all too necessary as lawmakers across this country seek to limit access to critical life-affirming care. As Representative Finke noted, just this last week, Utah became the first state this year to ban gender-affirming care for minors, following a number of other states last year, and more than 20 other states have bills under consideration currently, including our immediate neighbors of Iowa, North Dakota, and South Dakota. And there is every indication that this climate is worsening. The onslaught of legislation is having a real impact on the LGBTQ plus community. During 2022, as harmful laws advanced, I had conversations with a friend in Arkansas who had hoped to find their child an appointment for hormone therapy, only to watch in dismay as the state passed an outright ban on that care. A parent in Texas who I connected with legal resources after that state began investigating supportive families with trans children. One in Iowa who reached out to ask if Minnesota would be a safe state to raise their trans child. And I can point to countless more like those. It is critical that Minnesota takes a proactive stance on this issue. We cannot sit idly by while other states work to end essential evidence-based care. And I want to lift up the generations of trans and gender diverse people who have persevered, flourished, and laid the foundation for folks like me to live full and joyful lives here in this state. I urge you to advance this bill, to continue Minnesota's long history of protecting trans and gender diverse individuals, and to send a message that we are welcome and valued here in this state. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Rebecca Della Hunt and then Cass Casares on deck. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Rebecca Della Hunt, and I work as the Acting Director of Public Policy with Minnesota Family Council. HF 146 takes away custody from parents or guardians who deny their children access to gender-affirming health care, puberty blockers, and cross-sex hormones. Let's take a brief look into these drugs. The Office of the U.S. Surgeon General reports, sex hormones are extremely important in regulating the growth of the skeleton and maintaining the mass and strength of bone. A longitudinal study of a pubertal person undergoing hormonal treatment found that after 28 months of treatment, speed processing and memory of the patient were lower than before hormonal treatment. Loss of sexual function, bone density, and interference with brain development are just a few of the risks that puberty blockers pose for children who are told that this is a simple pause on puberty. Not only that, but in a clinical study of 70 children who were taking puberty blockers, all 70 of them later took cross-sex hormones. NHS of the UK claims cross-sex hormones cause some irreversible changes, and long-term cross-sex hormone treatment may cause temporary or even permanent infertility. Knowing that puberty blockers can lead to these side effects, let's look again at HF-146 at line 2.28. A court of the state has temporary emergency jurisdiction if the child is present in the state and the child has been unable to obtain gender-affirming health care. Under HF-146, parents lose custody rights if they make decisions based off concern for bone density and sexual function of their daughter. Members, based on today's short analysis of scientific research, I'm asking you to vote no on HF-146.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Cass Casares and then Kelsey Waits on deck. Please introduce yourself for the committee and then proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members and Representative Finke for having me. My name is Cass Casares. I am a non-binary trans person and my pronouns are they, them, and theirs. I live in St. Paul and I am here this morning to express my support for House File 146. We in Minnesota pride ourselves on being the best of the best in every way possible. This bill would be just another example of that in a time when we need it the most. Trans people are under attack across this country, especially and unfortunately, trans kids. I serve on several committees for a group called Tigers, where we work primarily with trans, intersex, and gender expansive kids and their families to help them find community. We do this in part through holding space for kids and teens to connect online and in person with COVID safety restrictions in place. Procedures. These meetings also allow parents to connect just the same. The work we do makes our community strong, and so would this bill. You may have seen stories about people moving from places like Texas and Florida to find safety for their families. Well, one of the places they're finding that safety is here in Minnesota, and that warms my heart. I am grateful to know that trans people like my partner and myself are protected in this state. But in the spirit of Minnesota Nice, I think we can go further. Some might say that this bill is revolutionary, but if it's passed, advanced and passed anyway, the impacts will be anything but. This bill would provide an extra sense of security for families who just want the best for their kids. That's what we all want, right? I am not the parent of a trans kid. I do not know what it's like to have to hide or to uproot your family and move sometimes across the country because of dangerous laws and dangerous people targeting your kids. But I am a trans adult. And even though I came out just a few years ago, I am an example of what can happen after a trans kid has a chance to thrive, to flourish, and to live as their true self. Committee members, I urge you to advance House File 146 to help other trans kids here in Minnesota and across the country get that chance. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Kelsey Waits and then Hannah Edwards. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Kelsey Waits. My pronouns are she, her. I am a constituent of Representative Weens. I am a proud parent of a transgender child, And I am also on the leadership team of Transparent Alliance, which is an organization aimed at providing education and support to parents of transgender youth. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among young people, and transgender youth are about 5 times more likely to attempt suicide than their cisgender peers. Research finds that trans youth are not prone to suicide risk due to their gender identity, but rather they are at a higher risk because of how they are treated by society. Research also shows that parental support changes these statistics, because when trans youth are supported and affirmed in their identities, they thrive. And yet, in states across the country, lawmakers are seeking to criminalize the very support that can save a child's life, putting parents in an unimaginable position. Do they seek affirming health care for their child in a different state and risk criminal prosecution? Or do they instead try to closet their child, dramatically increasing their child's risk of attempting suicide? A year and a half ago, my child was outed in our community. We experienced harassment due to their gender identity and have since moved. The messages that my child received from individuals in our community has had a large impact on their mental health. For many youth, it is not only individuals in a community sending these hateful messages, but the state itself. Minnesota has a chance to stand against this hate and save lives. Minnesota has a chance to protect families who are seeking the life-saving, gender-affirming care that is recommended by every major medical organization. Every major medical organization. It is not enough to stay silent in the face of bigotry and hate that is sweeping across this country. As Desmond Tutu said, if you are neutral in situations of injustice, you have chosen the side of the oppressor. I urge you to support HF 146 and support families with transgender children who need their access to health care protected. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And then finally, I have Hannah Edwards. Please introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
Yeah, good morning, representatives. My name is Hannah Edwards, and my pronouns are she, her. Thank you for having me here today, and thank you to Representative Finke for leading the work on this bill and for being a role model for my trans daughter. I'm here today because I'm the parent of an amazing 12-year-old transgender girl. I am also currently serving as the director of Transforming Families Minnesota. We're the state's largest and longest-running support network for trans youth and their caregivers. We run 4 monthly support meetings where our 800-plus members get support and share resources. I am so thankful that my family lives in the state of Minnesota, where my trans kid can access the health care that she needs to be healthy and happy. We have a fantastic care team at HCMC that she's been seeing since she was 8 years old. As the director of Transforming Families, I'm also here and there to answer emails and calls that parents and caregivers put in from all across the state of Minnesota looking for resources. I'm glad that I can direct those families to one of the many great gender-affirming clinics we have here in Minnesota. However, as the parent of a trans child and the director of Transforming Families, I also see many times where this is not the case. Right now, we have friends in Texas who are moving because they cannot safely get their trans child the care that they need. I weekly see parents post in the national groups that I am a part of to ask about which states will be safe for families with trans kids to seek refuge. We like to think that this is something that happens in states like Texas, Arkansas, Florida, Utah, but it isn't. Last Friday, an email came to the Transforming Families inbox from a scared mom of a trans kid in South Dakota. This mom was worried that her teenager, who was asking to start gender-affirming care, wouldn't be able to access it. She knew that South Dakota would not be a safe place for this. She was wondering if she came across the border to Minnesota, could she safely access care here? My 12-year-old is happy. She's creative. She loves to sing and act and perform. She's an amazing big sister. She is healthy and thriving, and that's because of what we offer here in Minnesota. This should be the reality for all trans youth. Please make Minnesota a beacon for those seeking care. Let us say to that parent from South Dakota that you and your trans child are safe to seek care in Minnesota. Healthcare is a human right, and all trans youth and their families deserve access to gender-affirming care. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. That wraps up the folks I had signed up ahead of time. Are there any other members of the public wishing to testify on this bill? Please introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Renee Carlson. I serve as general counsel for True North Legal. For children in Minnesota, getting an ear pierced and going on a field trip require parental consent. But HF 146 arguably bypasses parental engagement for something more significant, their child's medical decision making. This completely contradicts the myriad of case law regarding parental rights, both in Minnesota and the United States Supreme Court. The proposed bill also undermines the jurisdiction of courts across the country, impacting parents nationwide, because an unfit parent in a state court outside of Minnesota can still bring that child to Minnesota to get a life-altering medical treatment. House File 146 codifies experimental medicine into law despite studies and data from experts around the world who have taken a step back from the previous approach. New England's National Health Service is an example where, quote, NHS found that after a systematic review of evidence, it was appropriate to issue new draft guidance for the treatment of gender dysphoria in minors, which sharply deviates from the, quote, gender-affirming, end quote, approach, end quote. This bill champions what detransitioners refer to as medical malpractice. While other states are passing legislation to protect children, House File 146 enables kidnapping of children to escape custody orders, creating confusion and increased litigation for the courts, while stripping parents of their fundamental rights and encouraging young children on a dangerous path to self-destruction. Thank you.
All right. Anyone else? Please introduce yourself for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. My name is Hauen, that's H-A-O, last name N-G-U-Y-E-N. My wife and I are here today because we have a trans child. But I think a little history is important, and certainly it's not about my wife and I or me, but I came to this country when I was 9 years old from Vietnam. We were refugees, we were part of the South, we fled, and we came here. I'm a child of public assistance, I'm a child of English as a second language, which is now ELL. I became a police officer and served this state for 5 years, and I've been a member of the criminal justice system as a lawyer for the last 13. And although I'm a director of a very large prosecution division, I'm here in my capacity as a father. I talk about those things because as a person of color, sometimes you have to legitimize yourself to the group. You have to legitimize yourself with your voice, your cadence, and your mimicking. Sometimes you have to mimic whiteness to get success. But today, I do all those things, and we do all those things, my wife and I, because we can give Asher a voice. Asher is 6 years old. At three, she was not sleeping very well. She was waking up every single night. It was a lot more than just a toddler waking up. And one day I picked her up from daycare, and all the teachers had said, Asher told us that she's a she. And I said to these wonderful daycare people who had never had a trans kid before at a pretty religious place, so what'd you do? And they said, we called her a her. And I said, great. Oh my God, great. And Ashford comes around the corner and I said, hey, there's my beautiful daughter. And I think there are a few things in this world that are I'll remember for my whole life, and that is one of them. The smile on her face, the look of affirmation, the confidence she had to tell her teachers, who had known her since diapers, that she was a she. Didn't matter that she was born with a penis. That her father said, "There's my beautiful daughter." That's what Minnesota should be. That's who we are. We are a state that invites refugees to become educated, to become professional, to become public servants, to then add to this state. We are a state that encourages wonderful love and openness, who then can raise a trans child, who then will stay here and add to this community and develop it even further. We are people who come and vote and then run for office and make us stronger. That's who we are. This stuff about kidnapping and mutilation, that's all just fear stuff. That is all just scare everybody things. There's a six-year-old girl that is at home. My wife was talking to her this morning. Gretchen was talking to her this morning. Actually, I'm sorry, I'm a little emotional. It was last night. Hey, we're going to go to the Capitol. We're going to look at this bill. There's this really wonderful person, you know, all this stuff, who delivered the bill. And Asher goes, "Yay!" And Gretchen thought, oh, my God, she understands what we're talking about. No, she found a little golden penny that she had lost on the steps for like 6 months. Asher doesn't care. Not yet. Asher can't speak for herself. Not right now. But we can. My wife and I can. There are people here who are trans who have spoken. There's a representative who's fighting for that. So it isn't about fear. Stop scaring people. Let parents, with the help of educated professionals who are medical doctors, decide what is best for their child. And then when that child gets older, they get to decide too. I urge you to do what really has led to my success in this state, what has really led to, you know, my willingness and wanting to stay in public service and work, which is what Minnesota is. We are a haven. We are a leader. And today, I would urge you to vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Do we have anybody else from the audience wishing to testify? You can come down. Please introduce yourself for the committee and go ahead with your testimony.
Absolutely. Thank you. Good morning. Thank you for having me. My name is Amber Mum. I use she, her pronouns. I'm a member of the St. Cloud Hive of the Parents and Allies of Trans Youth, the Transgender Movement for Liberation, and a member of the Tea Time Support Group run by the Aliveness Project. I am also a proud transgender woman, but more importantly, I am the mother of two wonderful transgender and gender expansive children. I drove down from St. Cloud to show my support for House File 146 and thank Representative Finke for introducing such an important and life-saving bill to protect trans children and their families at such a critical time for us. As you may be aware, there's a torrent of damaging, ill-informed, and outright malicious legislation being introduced across the country targeting transgender and gender-expansive people broadly, but trans children in particular. It is our daily experience to be forced to keep track of which state is safe for us to visit. Minnesota has been overall very accepting and supportive of our family, but even then we don't feel 100% safe and assured that we will be able to get the gender-affirming care that both of my kids need and deserve. Very recently, an amendment was proposed to House File 16 in Minnesota, which bans children's conversion therapy in an attempt to ban essential health care for transgender children. This happened in our state. Because of this, my trans partner and I frequently discuss plans to flee the country if these targeted, hateful bills keep being introduced or passed. I never thought that it would come to this, but here we are. Even in a state that is considered safer for trans children and their families, being forced from our homes and having to seek asylum elsewhere is an almost daily conversation in my community. As someone who started transitioning well into her adulthood, I know better than most how essential and life-saving gender-affirming medical care is. Going through NABLE puberty was a traumatizing experience for me. I am so grateful that trans and gender expansive kids have access to the knowledge and medical care to be their full selves and thrive. To not only deny them life-saving medical care, but to charge and prosecute supportive parents and healthcare professionals is barbaric and morally repugnant. House File 146 would give parents of transgender children like myself, and more importantly, transgender and gender expansive children themselves across the nation, a safe haven and in an overwhelmingly supportive community. I urge the committee to move House File 146 forward and ultimately pass it to protect the rights and futures of our beloved and precious transgender children and their families. Thank you.
Thank you. If there's anyone else from the public wishing to testify, if you could move closer to the table so we can fit folks in, that would be helpful. Yep. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Mo Mac Williams, M-O. M.A.C. Williams, and when I came out as trans in 2015, I never expected that within a decade we would be facing the sorts of genocidal policies that we are across the country. And when I say genocidal, I mean denying health care to trans youth does not reduce transness, does not make transness go away. It makes people go away. And I really just wanted to sit here and express how intense it feels to have accessed care after years of needing care, finally accessing it. Is really amazing, and then to see people want to take that away is heartbreaking. I'm confused. I would recommend you do some soul searching and a little reflection on what may have made you think that kids don't deserve bodily autonomy. Protect trans kids, protect trans lives. We matter. Stop killing us. Thank you for the bill. I really, really appreciate it. Oh, it's okay, I didn't notice. It's all good.
Thank you. Anyone else from the public wishing to testify? Come on up. Yep, we have to wrap with the committee in 3 minutes, so. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I'll try to talk fast. I could talk for hours, but I think I can make it short. My name is Shelley Kang. My pronouns are and have always been she, her. I'm very comfortable with who I am, and I'm very comfortable with having two teenagers who are both in the LGBTQIA mafia. One considers themselves non-binary. We're in the process of getting their name legally changed right now. And the other one is still figuring out exactly where they are. They are who they are. And this is sharing maybe more personal information than they would want to share if they were here personally. Both of them have attempted suicide as teenagers, trying to figure out who they are and live as who they are. Openly. We've had a very comfortable, honest relationship with our kids and respectful of their needs from birth on up in our family. We live in a liberal bubble of supportive families in our neighborhood in St. Louis Park. Our children have always known that they are loved and cared for within our bubble. But living in our community, even in a relatively liberal part of our liberal state, they feel rejection on a regular basis. And they have gone to treatment, like inpatient partial hospitalization treatment that often involves group therapy. And in that group therapy, they've encountered other kids just like them who are trying to find their identity and feel comfortable with who their body and their brain tells them that they need to be. And those kids are dealing with parents and families who are throwing away their underwear of choice, or who are refusing to call them by their pronouns that are appropriate for them. And that is causing those children trauma on top of the trauma that they face every day in our community by people who give them dirty looks, don't want to be their friends, think that there's something wrong or evil with them. And what I want to tell you is that my children are the most, and the people, the trans people that I have met and encountered in this world, you know what, there is good and bad, sinful and saints everywhere you go in every aspect of our society. But most of the trans and LGBTQ people I've met, they are the kindest, most gentle and giving people because they know how hard it is to be judged, so they give grace to everybody else. And to the people who are parents in this world who are afraid of affirming gender, this is the last thing I have to say. I know our time is short. My biggest thing that I hold on to is I love my kids so much. I want them to be alive this year and next year and when I am older. And I want them to be willing to talk to me. I want to have a strong relationship with my children. And for adults who refuse to accept their children the way they are, guess what? You're not going to see them much once they turn into adults and have their own financial freedom. They're going to push you away. I'm sure you've seen stories in the news about boomers complaining that their kids won't talk to them anymore. I can guarantee you, as a human being to another human being, your children will reject you if you reject them. And as our state, we need to set it up so it's less scary for parents to stand up and affirm their children. And we need to make it safe for people from other states to do the same. Let's be the proud, wonderful, caring, giving state that Minnesota has always tried to be. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
And thank you for doing this.
We're going to have to wrap up. I do want to thank all the testifiers and thank everybody who is here, especially those who shared some vulnerable testimony. It really is important for us to have that on the record. Representative Finke, and we're laying this over. I recognize this first time that we've ever heard this issue, that it was probably going to take up some more time. So at a future date, we'll have time for committee discussion on the bill. But at this time, I'll let you have the closing words, Representative Finke.
I just want to say thank you. Thank you, Chair Becker-Finn. Thank you, members, for listening. And thank you to everyone from the community that came. This is our first convening, but it will not be our last. And, let's keep up the good fight.
All right, we're going to end as close to on time as I can. And with that, the bill is laid over, and we are adjourned.